Hello, Peculiars. Welcome back. We have a guest who some of you hopefully will remember. Wendy Moore has been with us before and always a treat. And she's back with a book that I think is going to be right up our street. Wendy, welcome aboard. So glad to have you.
Hi again, Brandy, it's lovely to meet you again.
Yes, it's so good. And I, you know, in our last meeting, we got to see your lovely face on our show. This time it's part of our audio podcast, which is, in fact, something we've been expanding to do more of. So many of our listeners actually prefer podcasting over the video cast. So we've added quite a number of these. And it's exciting to have you on, not just because we love you, Wendy, but also because this book, oh, this is such an exciting book. It's called Jack and Eve: Two Women in Love and at War. And this is a wonderful story. I actually was not, despite the fact that I do all of this research on LGBTQ history, I did not know this story. This is super exciting for me.
Well, I think it's an incredible story. And obviously, it's one that most people won't have heard about. And that's really why I wanted to bring it to wider public knowledge.
Yes. Well, so what's interesting to me is they both had such interesting lives where they were breaking gender stereotypes. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Jack and Eve and who they were, and then we'll get into a little bit of, you know, how you came up with this and what sort of research you had to do.
Okay. Well, Jack was Vera Home. She liked to call herself Jack. She came from a middle-class Victorian background. Really kind of very conventional, but she was always interested in male pursuits. So when she had to make her own way in the world, and she decided to become an actress and was particularly interested in doing cross-dressing roles. Mm-hmm. So she went on the stage, she dressed as a page boy and a kind of Victorian dandy. And she reveled in those unconventional gender roles, really. She met Eve, who was Evelina Haverfield, in the suffragette movement in 1908. And so Eve had been born into the aristocracy. She was the third daughter of a baron, and they made their home in Scotland. She was 14 years older than Jack, and she'd been married twice and had two children. But they were kindred spirits. They call themselves twin souls, and they just became devoted for life. And within the suffragettes, they became a kind of power couple almost.
I love it.
They were activists. They both went to prison for their beliefs, and they were kind of publicized on postcards as suffragette pinups, really.
Oh, I love it. Well, and I've seen some wonderful sort of both of them really in somewhat masculine dress. And I've seen Jack in men's hats and things. And, you know, I just came off doing research on a book on early transgender identity and the value and the power of cross-dressing. And so it's just really interesting to come across this story. And you're right, they are powerful public figures. This is not something you expect. They weren't exactly hiding themselves away, you know? They were out there being public faces for a whole movement.
They were, but at the same time, they were hiding in plain sight because although they were together always, on suffragette marches, they'd always be on horseback together. They were frequently pictured together. They made no secret of their relationship, but most people just assumed that it was perfectly normal for two women to live together. They didn't think anything more of it. But
right.
What's quite interesting, I think, about Jack and Eve is that they're one of the rare examples in lesbian history of two women who actually there is evidence of them having a physical relationship. So they lived together in a cottage that they call Peace Cottage. And they had a double bed, which Jack actually engraved with their initials on either side. And Jack also left love poems to Evelina, which make clear their physical relationship. So they really did break molds. And I think Jack in particular, she called herself Jack, by the way, after one of the characters that she played who was called Jack, and she liked that name and she took it on board. But she in particular, I think, really pioneered what we might think of as perhaps a modern lesbian identity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's interesting too that, as we all know, right, for many, many long years, they just assumed that if there was no man, no penis involved, that it couldn't be sex, you know? And so you really had this bizarre way in which there weren't the kinds of suspicions of women frequently. People just went, oh, they're such good friends, you know? Wonderful. So, and it still makes it, it's still hard to make the argument, even for some of the folks that I was researching in Berlin, which was a pretty permissive in the Weimar Republic, and women who were out as couples, still people being like, oh, they're such good friends. You know, if there wasn't some kind of physical evidence, people just sort of brush it under the rug. And so it's really wonderful that there's this, that you can follow that thread. So my question for you is, how did you come across the story? Did you always know the story? You know, what led you to this?
I really came across the story when I was researching my previous book. So my previous book, by chance, was also about two women who were life partners and who ran a military hospital in London in the First World War called Endell Street. And so those two women had also been in the suffragette movement. And it was while I was researching the suffragettes that I saw a photograph of Jack. So one of her roles in the suffragettes was that she became official chauffeur to Mrs. Pankhurst. And so this photograph showed her in her chauffeur's uniform, in her peaked cap, next to the official car. And she just looked as if she was having the best possible time. She's grinning broadly. And she just reveled in being mistaken for a man quite often. She talks about how she'd drive up to country homes and the maids would mistake her for a male chauffeur and they would be simpering. So she just loved it all. She loved the ambiguity of it all. And so that's how I found her. And then I discovered that she'd actually left a large treasure trove of material, including diaries that she kept from about the age of 19 till almost when she died. And she died in 1969. So these diaries span a huge portion of the 20th century. And although she was quite discreet in lots of ways, so she used codes sometimes to suggest her different liaisons with women, she does also talk about her feelings to some extent. And so that was a real window into her life and the life of suffragettes at the time.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's so difficult to find that kind of material, and how wonderful. And I'm surprised that more hasn't been done with it. I'm shocked that I haven't heard of this person, given my interest in the area already. And so, first of all, thank you for bringing her so much to our notice, and Evelina as well. But what I think is also fascinating is they didn't just walk around, you know, they didn't just go around being suffragettes, which is dangerous enough and you could be in prison for. They get involved in the war effort, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I think their view, both of them, was that women could do absolutely anything a man could do, and that they wanted to do that. So Evelina, she was a real adventurer. Although she looked very elegant and classy, and she was very refined and polished, she loved to go hunting. She'd actually been big game hunting at some point. She'd been to America traveling. She went to an opium den in San Francisco and smoked opium pipe. So she was a real adventurer too. So they always wanted to be in the midst of the action. So whether that was in the suffragettes or the First World War. And so when the First World War broke out, she was really one of the first women to do anything at all. So within 2 days of the war starting, she linked up with another suffragette and they set up an organisation to recruit women into men's jobs.
Oh, so
that's called the Women's Emergency Corps. And she even wanted to get women to shoulder rifles and defend the country in case it was invaded.
Right.
So she absolutely believed that women could and should do anything that a man could do. So for the first 6 months or so of the war, she was very busy organising women's work on the home front. Mm-hmm. But they also really wanted to be in the thick of the action. So one of Eve's sons was had joined the army, and he was fighting. Jack's brother was also fighting. So they wanted to be in the thick of it too. And so they joined an organisation called the Scottish Women's Hospitals, which had been set up by a Scottish surgeon called Elsie Ingalls, another remarkable woman. Mm-hmm. And they went with Elsie Ingalls to Serbia.
Okay.
And they began to run hospitals, and Jack in particular drove ambulances there.
Of course, and probably mechanic to them as well.
Oh, she did, absolutely. There was no alternative.
That's amazing. Well, and then I know it's like she, as an ambulance driver, she was actually going to the front lines to get the wounded, right? I mean, she was literally traveling there into the danger zone and collecting people, if I read that right.
Yeah, well, later on, certainly that was the case. So in Serbia, basically, they were running field hospitals and fetching, ferrying Serbian soldiers between hospitals. And then the Germans and Austrians invaded, and they were captured and they became prisoners of war. So for several months, they were imprisoned in a military hospital, but they did their treat Serbian soldiers. So they were helping the Serbian, our allies, the British allies in Serbia. Then they were sent home, and instead of resting on their laurels, they immediately set out again. So they went with another Scottish Women's Hospitals outfit to Russia and ended up on the Dobruja front bordering the Black Sea. So there they really were in the kind of worst possible situation,
right?
Because they ran hospitals right up to the front line. Eve was in charge of a unit of 24 ambulances, which were all driven by women. And those women did drive up to the firing line, rescued wounded Russians and Romanians and Serbian soldiers. And then when they were forced to retreat, they retreated with the army. But all the time, they were at the back of the line. So they were constantly having to go back and pick up the wounded.
Right.
And in fact, they were the only motorised ambulances at that front. So the other ambulances were all horse-drawn. So they were really in demand and made a massive difference.
That is amazing. I mean, it's just, you know, this is the kind of thing we talk about all the time, that there's all of these amazing histories that you never hear. And then you'll hear the same sort of hero story over and over and over again, you know, if it involves sort of a white man. So there's a process of kind of digging out, of having to kind of pry stories loose from history's grip. And so I wonder, you know, where did you go to, just about the research side, because I'm fascinated, where did you go to find all the detail? I mean, is it all in one place? Did you have to travel?
A bit of both. I mean, yeah, the research side is my favourite bit as well. I love doing that, messing around in archives. So I was really lucky because Jack had kept all these diaries and also lots of letters and photographs, because she was also an avid photographer herself. And these were preserved by her family, and then they were then donated to the Women's Library, which is a library in London. And so that's where I consulted those. Getting to Eve was a little bit more complicated, mm-hmm. because her descendants had gone to Canada. And so I managed to get in touch with family members there and in this country. And so they shared with me a travel diary that she kept and other materials. But apart from that, I mean, I spent a lot of time in other libraries and archives looking at material to do with the Scottish Women's Hospitals, and went out to Serbia as well.
Okay.
So that I could go and visit the places where they'd worked and see what was left of them there.
You know, it is so, I think that's so important, the sort of on the ground research. And I was very lucky for my last book that came out, Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher, I managed to get to Moscow, which probably will never happen again. So, but it makes such a big difference when you can walk the streets even. I went to Berlin. Berlin, it's a little bit more difficult because Berlin was massively bombarded, so nothing's there that was there really. But it's still, I don't know, there's something powerful about making that connection, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even when, you know, I went to Serbia and there wasn't much to be seen of the hospitals that they'd worked in, but it was just a question of walking in their footsteps, mm-hmm. and in that case, driving in their road tracks, in a sense. Because, you know, I was driving on roads and I knew that they had driven over these very same roads, albeit much more potholed and muddy and broken down at the time.
Yes. Well, in the World War One theater, we as a book club also read Facemaker by Lindsay Fitzharris last year. She had a lot of firsthand accounts of the trenches, and you know, you think, oh, they were driving ambulances and rescuing people. Then you read a book like that and go, this is horrifying. Like, they were in dismal, terrible conditions. I'm sure that your book probably dwells on that. It wasn't an easy thing at all. This was not easy living.
No, by no means. I mean, I'm completely in awe of what they put up with. These women were driving ambulances, but they had to maintain them too. So mm-hmm. they had to fill them with petrol. They had to find petrol. The ambulances were always breaking down on these bad roads and getting punctures. So they'd have to change tires in the midst of bombs dropping. At the same time, you know, they were on the retreat, so it was very difficult to find food. But I did sort of turn to lots of different personal accounts as well as what Jack and Eve wrote about it. And these women, they were always just really thinking of the wounded patients that they had with them. So they were driving under gunfire, but they were trying to prop somebody up in the front seat who with a massive head injury at the same time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's absolutely shocking and incredible, I think, what they put up with. Eve, who was in charge of them, she did push them rather too far because she seemed to think that they should put up with everything that the men in the trenches put up with. So they weren't even supposed to have a change of clothing. And they did rebel against her and mutiny, for which I can completely sympathise with, really. They were absolutely incredible, brave, astonishing women, really.
And it's really fascinating. My question is, you said, I didn't realise, Jack lived into the 60s then.
Mm-hmm. 69, yeah.
69, my goodness. I mean, you know, it's so funny because I think we... And some of this is because, you know, photographs are black and white. We think it's such a long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago. You know, these people lived into an era that feels quite familiar to us. And so what went on? What happened with the rest of their lives? I mean, I know the book focuses a lot on their activities during World War One and after. I don't want you to give away any spoilers, but I mean, I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, well, they did have a quite unconventional relationship. So although they were devoted throughout their lives, Jack did have various dalliances. So that was happening. At the end of the war, Jack was living with somebody else, with a Scottish artist, and in a threesome, in fact, a triangular relationship with another artist as well. While Eve had gone out back to Serbia and she was opening orphanages to take in Serbian children. But when she called for Jack, Jack was immediately out there. So Jack came to join her. And then very sadly, only a couple of years later, 1920, Eve died. So she died in Serbia. She had gone out in a snowstorm to be a translator for a doctor for some patients and caught pneumonia and never recovered. So she's buried in Serbia.
I was just about to ask if you'd managed to visit her grave.
Yeah, so that was part of my visit when I was there. She's still revered as a hero in Serbia. And in the village in which she's buried, hers is the only grave in the churchyard. So the local priest still looks after that grave, and every year they have a ceremony to remember her.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that's astonishing. So Jack was utterly bereft.
Of course.
She'd lost her lifelong partner. She'd lost her base. She'd never had a home of her own, really. She never had any money, so she was always dependent on others. And she ended up, she carried on running the orphanage initially, but then she moved to Scotland with two of the women who had been running the orphanage with her. And they lived a very happy, harmonious relationship for several years. They became known as the Ladies of Lochearnhead.
Oh, I love this. I love this. I want t-shirts. Oh my gosh.
I mean, they just were incredible. I mean, they, you know, she's carried on wearing, you know, male clothes to some extent, mm-hmm. you know, tailored suits and short cropped hair. So she just never compromised. And even though really after the First World War, there was quite a big backlash against
yes.
women who'd been taking on these kind of very dominant active roles and against lesbians too.
Yeah.
But she just never seemed to let that bother her. She just carried on being who she was, doing what she did. And
Get on. I feel like we'd get on. I have short cropped hair. I wear tailored suits. I'm all about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was she was a pioneer, a trailblazer. But yeah, she lived on more or less happily until 1969.
And it's, again, I mean, just to reiterate how, so for instance, in my book that I just did, it sort of covers the interwar period. And I'm sort of astonished at how some things now feel like some things then. And it doesn't really seem, it's not so far away. And I think it's so powerful for us to read these stories of, you know, here we have women living their lives, you know, out loud, living their lives boldly, showing that they could do anything men could do, you know, kind of establishing a lesbian identity so much earlier than people give that credit for. And we're in the midst of another backlash, especially here in the United States, against LGBTQ folk. And so I think, you know, it's such a perfect time for this story, this kind of story to appear.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think for women in particular, it's usually, you know, one step, or maybe two steps forward and one step back.
But frequently.
It seems that women make these gains and then get pushed back again. I suppose one of the reasons I wanted to write this story is that it should be an inspiration for people today. I think it's inspiring to know that these women were trailing these paths before us, really. Refusing to conform.
It's powerful, and it's also it's nice to know we're standing on the shoulders of giants, so to speak. People came before us, people will come after us, and I think that that's another thing that feels good about a story like this one. It reminds us that we're part of a continuity. I wanted to ask if you had any sort of favorite bits, anything that just really was your go to, like, oh yeah, that was the best part.
they were both so characterful, and so I think there's quite a few stories, but Eve always, you know, she was quite handy with a gun, really.
Oh.
And so there's two stories that are connected. So in the Suffragettes, she was arrested trying to invade the Houses of Parliament, and she was arrested for hitting a policeman. And so in court, she said, well, next time I'll bring a revolver. And she quite probably would have done that. And then when they were out in Serbia at one point, they were running a camp hospital there. And suddenly there was a gunshot. And it turned out that somebody had been trying to steal money from their tent. And so Eve responded that it didn't bother her because she always slept with the money under her pillow. And she always had a revolver and Jack with her to look after her. So that's the kind of women they were.
I like this. Yeah, very Wild West kind of thing. It's just such a great story. And to Peculiars, for our Peculiars who are in the UK, this is already, it's available to pre-order. It's coming out, remind me again.
It's coming out next week on the 4th of April.
Oh, 4th of April. Okay, so it's possible that by the time we get our podcast up, it might already be available. So if you're in the UK, it is purchasable on in various locations. If you are not in the UK, however, if you're in the United States, it isn't being published in the US, but you can get the Kindle or the audiobook without having to worry about shipping from Amazon UK, from the UK Amazon site, and it is it's up there now, and you can get the hardback too. But of course, then you have shipping to deal with. But it is available. I highly recommend. I love audiobooks. I know. I think Karen Cass is the narrator for the book.
Well, you know more than I do. So
we're big fans of audiobooks here at the Peculiar Book Club. I listen to a lot of our books as audiobooks when I'm working out before shows. So the audiobook and the Kindle is something you can get on Amazon. Again, the title is Jack and Eve, Two Women in Love and at War, releasing next week, or again, perhaps the week previous, if you're getting this podcast a little bit late. So thank you so much for joining us. It has been wonderful to have you on again, Wendy, and I hope that this just does rounds and rounds and rounds of excellent success. What a wonderful story that you've brought to us.
Oh, thank you so much, Brandy. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you again. I've really enjoyed myself.
Yes, thank you. And to all of you Peculiar listeners, thank you for joining us at a place where, if you're weird, you're family.